for the betterment of all. Let's also set some kind of ceiling above which we really are collecting a lot of taxes for the betterment of society. It's called social democracy. But I don't need I'm fine with markets dictating resource allocation for consumer electronics, vehicles, products of different kinds. I'm OK with that. I think it's OK. I think if you build something and it's a company and it's yours and you built it, I don't think that should be taken away from you. However, we recognize that you built it based on utility infrastructure established by the government and through taxation, protection for intellectual property established by the government, presumably with employees, many of whom went to public schools, which is paid for by through tax. Right. When we recognize, well, yeah, you organized the structure and you built it. And so you do deserve many of the fruits of that labor. It was also built on the backs of all sorts of government infrastructure and tax dollars, et cetera, et cetera. So that's why we have to cycle back a portion of it into the betterment of society. That's fundamentally social democracy. It is a left-wing perspective. I would argue it's the most successful version of progressive ideology globally over the last 150 years. OK, so that's my perspective. We've got a great bonus show for you today. Absolutely insane travel chaos. And it's not just Omicron causing it. We will talk about Hillary Clinton's interesting 2024 prediction. We'll talk about how on earth do schools reopen with Omicron spreading so wildly. And much more. All of those stories on today's bonus show. Sign up at joinpacman.com and you can use the coupon code WOW22. And when you type it in, you have to say WOW22. It saves you big. You get access to the bonus show. You join the ranks of membership for what will be a really important election year. I'll see you then.
WRCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1940.
Hello, my fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Technoland? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
Folks, glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-syllable word.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet, because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
WRCT, the insane from way out.
Holocaust. It's a very very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
And to give you a sense of how transformative this would be the largest ever one-year decrease in child poverty in the history of the United States of America.
Those were the words of President Biden just 6 months ago, hailing the expansion of the child tax credit. Now the program's already ended thanks to opposition from Senator Joe Manchin. While the monthly payments kept millions of children out of poverty, many immigrant families got no assistance at all. We'll look at what this has meant for New Bedford, Massachusetts, the largest seafood port on the eastern seaboard, the focus of a new Marshall Project investigation headlined Essential But Excluded. Then we look at what's happening in the sprawling network of private immigration jails amidst the latest surge of Omicron. Then to Europe, where a French humanitarian group filed a complaint against British and French officials over the drowning of 27 refugees in the English Channel. Family members say their loved ones could have been saved.
They all had phones, internet, and SIM cards, and they could have located them before they drowned. And they actually called the French police and the British police. So we feel that the police betrayed us because they went to them 12 hours after they drowned. So after these 12 hours, they were dead.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Global coronavirus cases have skyrocketed to a new record high, with more than 2.2 million confirmed cases reported Monday. In Southern Africa, cases are soaring in Mozambique, where President Filipe Nyusi said Monday he and his wife have tested positive for coronavirus and are self-isolating. Botswana's president, Mokgweetsi Masisi, also entered isolation Monday after a positive test. Australia recorded nearly 50,000 daily cases, a record high in a country that until recently had prevented large-scale community spread of the virus. In France, lawmakers are debating a vaccine pass law that would require anyone 12 or older to present a vaccination certificate to enter restaurants and other public venues.
Let us not lose sight of the fact that the objective of this law is not to restrict individual and collective liberties of the French people. The objective of this law is to save lives. It is to protect our hospitals and relieve the workload of our healthcare workers.
Across the United States, more than a million positive coronavirus tests were reported Monday, shattering the previous single-day record. U.S. hospitalizations are rising rapidly, with COVID-19 patients now occupying more than 100,000 hospital beds. On Monday, the Food and Drug Administration extended emergency use authorization for the Pfizer-BioNTech COVID-19 booster shot to include children aged 12 to 15. Shots could begin later this week if the CDC signs off on the move. This comes as more than 3,200 schools around the United States canceled in-person learning this week amidst the surge in cases. In Florida, which has a test positivity rate of over 26%, Republican Governor Ron DeSantis on Monday rejected demands he open more coronavirus testing sites and once again rejected calls to require public health measures like masking and social distancing in schools.
Kids need to be in school. They do not need to be doing any crazy mitigation. Just let them be kids. I think it's pretty clear a lot of this mitigation, it hasn't worked, period.
Over 3,000 flights into and out of or within the United States were canceled Monday as airlines struggled with staffing shortages and winter weather. Meanwhile, the coffee chain Starbucks has become the latest corporate giant to require workers to get vaccinated against COVID-19 or get tested weekly for coronavirus. On Capitol Hill, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said Monday he'll schedule a vote on rolling back the filibuster by January 17th, the official holiday celebrating Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday, unless Republicans end their obstruction of voting rights legislation. Currently, a pair of bills, the Freedom to Vote Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, don't have the 60-vote supermajority needed to overcome a Republican filibuster in the 100-member Senate. By Monday, nearly 60 groups had signed on to an open letter asking senators to reform the legislative filibuster to protect democracy. They cited a recent deal that saw Republican leader Mitch McConnell agree to a one-time exemption to the filibuster, allowing Democrats to raise the ceiling on the national debt, writing, quote, just as we needed to extend the debt limit to avoid economic calamity, we need to pass federal democracy and voting legislation to safeguard our democracy. Two Democrats, Senators Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona and Joe Manchin of West Virginia, have said they oppose Democrats' push to abolish the filibuster, which critics call a relic of the Jim Crow era. Iraq's military says it shot down a pair of explosives-laden drones Monday as they approached a military base near Baghdad's airport where U.S. troops are stationed. The attack came after thousands of Iraqi protesters gathered in Baghdad to mark the second anniversary of the killing of Qasem Soleimani, a top Iranian general and Iraqi militia leader who was assassinated in a U.S. drone attack ordered by then-President Trump. On Monday, the Iranian president, Ibrahim Raisi, said Trump and former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo should face justice for Soleimani's murder.
If a just prosecution court is set up for Trump, Pompeo, and the other criminals where they are prosecuted for this shocking crime and they face the consequences of their horrible actions, then so be it. If not, do not doubt that I will tell every American official that the fist of revenge will extend from the sleeve of the Islamic community.
Haitian Prime Minister Ariel Henry said Monday he's forced to flee the northern city of Gonaïves on New Year's Day after his convoy came under fire from members of a criminal gang. The gunfire reportedly left one person dead, two others injured. Human rights groups estimate criminal gangs control over half of Haiti's territory, filling a power vacuum left behind by the assassination of President Jovenel Moïse in July and a devastating earthquake in August. Brazil's far-right president Jair Bolsonaro was hospitalized in Sao Paulo Monday with abdominal pain that doctors said was caused by an intestinal blockage. It was the latest in a string of health problems Bolsonaro has faced since he was stabbed in the abdomen during a 2018 campaign event. He faces the prospect of surgery just 9 months out from presidential elections. Bolsonaro's hospitalization came as environmentalists warned deforestation in Brazil's vast Cerrado region last year spiked to its highest level since 2015 as Bolsonaro's government encouraged large-scale development by agribusiness companies and cattle ranchers. This is environmental scientist Ana Alencar.
Deforestation is the most naked and raw indicator of the terrible environmental policy of President Jair Bolsonaro's government.
In California, a federal jury in San Jose has found Elizabeth Holmes guilty of defrauding investors who poured hundreds of millions of dollars into the blood testing startup Theranos. Holmes founded Theranos in 2003 at the age of 19. A decade later, she announced her company had produced a medical device that could test for more than 200 health conditions with only a few drops of blood. In fact, the device could run only a small number of such tests, and Theranos secretly relied on larger commercially available blood testing machines means for its results. Holmes attracted large investments from billionaires, including media mogul Rupert Murdoch, members of the Walton family, and the family of former Education Secretary Betsy DeVos. Holmes was found guilty on 4 of 11 counts of wire fraud and conspiracy related to misleading investors. She faces up to 20 years in prison for each of the 4 charges. The white-collar criminals rarely face such a steep penalty. She posted bond and will remain free as she appeals Monday's verdict, a process that could take years. A newly unveiled 2009 confidential settlement between convicted predator and sex trafficker, the late Jeffrey Epstein, and survivor Virginia Giuffre. It has revealed Giuffre agreed to restrictions on her ability to sue others involved in Epstein's network of abuse. The deal also awarded Giuffre a payment of $500,000. The settlement was made public as part of a lawsuit Giuffre filed against British royal Prince Andrew last year, and may impact whether Giuffre's suit moves forward. Prince Andrew's lawyers are expected to argue again for a dismissal of her case against him today. Giuffre's accused convicted sex trafficker Ghislaine Maxwell of trafficking her to Prince Andrew when Giuffre was 17 years old. Republican lawmakers who voted last year to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election received over $8 million in campaign donations from corporations and trade groups, even after the deadly January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. That's according to data compiled by the watchdog group Accountable. The report focuses on 20 Fortune 500 companies and 10 industry groups, including Boeing, Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, Chevron, ExxonMobil, Merck, and Pfizer, that continued funneling money to GOP lawmakers even after the violent riot and unfounded claims of fraud in the 2020 election. In a statement, Accountable said, quote, "Major corporations were quick to condemn the insurrection and tout their support for democracy, and almost as quickly, many ditched those purported values by cutting big checks to the very politicians that helped instigate the failed coup attempt," unquote. This comes as over 200 vigils are scheduled to take place across U.S. cities and towns Thursday to mark the first anniversary of the January 6th attack on the Capitol. New York Attorney General Letitia James has subpoenaed former President Donald Trump's 2 eldest children, Donald Trump Jr. and Ivanka Trump, as part of a civil investigation into Trump's business practices. Their involvement was revealed in court documents that were filed Monday as the Trump Organization continues to attempt to block James from questioning Trump and his children. James has been investigating whether the Trump Organization inflated the values of its properties to obtain loans and then reduced them to evade taxes. And Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador has confirmed he's asked former U.S. President Trump to pardon WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange and reiterated he'd offer Assange asylum in Mexico. This is AMLO speaking Monday from Mexico City.
Antes de que terminara la administración.
Before President Trump's term was over, I sent him a letter requesting a pardon for Assange so that he'd be exonerated. As you know, when the presidents of the United States end their term, they can exercise this right. I sent him the letter and got no response. We believe the United States government should act humanely. Assange is sick, and it would be a show of solidarity and fraternity to grant him asylum wherever he would choose to live, including Mexico.
A British court in December ruled in favor of the Biden administration's appeal to extradite Assange to face espionage charges in the United States. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy. Happy New Year to you and to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
And happy news year to you, Juan, and to everyone. Well, as COVID cases reach record highs in the United States, a key Biden administration program that helped keep millions of children out of poverty has just ended. Over the past 6 months, the Treasury Department has sent monthly payments of up to $300 per child to 30 million families as part of the expanded Child Tax Credit program. The Biden administration and the Democratic leadership in Congress had hoped to continue the payments by including it as part of the Build Back Better package, but the plan has been blocked by Democratic Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia. Economists fear child poverty could soar in the United States as a result. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer has vowed to bring the Build Back Better Act to a vote soon in the Senate, but its passage seems unlikely without support from both Manchin and fellow Democrat Kyrsten Sinema. We turn now to look at how this is playing out in one city in New England, New Bedford, Massachusetts, the largest commercial fishing port on the eastern seaboard. Immigrants, many undocumented, play key roles in the fishing industry and have worked throughout the pandemic despite the risks. However, many of these same immigrant workers have been shut out of pandemic aid, and so have their children, many of whom were born in the United States and are U.S. citizens. The Marshall Project recently published a detailed investigation into the crisis facing families in New Bedford. The article is headlined "Essential but Excluded." It was written by Julia Preston and Ariel Goodman, who join us now. Julia Preston's a contributing writer at the Marshall Project, former reporter at the New York Times, where she covered immigration for years and was part of a Pulitzer Prize-winning team in 1998. Ariel Goodman is the TOE Audience Engagement Fellow at the Marshall Project. She's also my niece. Julia Preston, let's begin with you. This is a deep piece because it really puts a face on who suffers in this country, not only when the child tax credit ends, as it has, but for those who missed out on it completely. If you can lay out what you found in New Bedford and who these essential but excluded immigrants are.
Well, the community that we found in New Bedford are mostly immigrants from Guatemala, from the highlands of Guatemala. They are, it's a community of Mayan, Quiche speaking indigenous people, and they work in the plants across the waterfront that where they pack seafood. They're scallops, haddock, the food that was actually keeping Americans fed during the pandemic when so many people had to stay home. It was not an option for these workers to stay home, however, because many of them are undocumented and they were not eligible for unemployment insurance of any kind. They were not eligible for some of the enhanced stimulus payments that came from as a result of COVID, starting under President Trump and including under President Biden. And they were not eligible for certain kinds of tax credits. But actually, because they are taxpayers, they were eligible for the enhanced tax credit, child tax credit, that President Biden made available through the Rescue Act last March.
And Julia, the estimates, as I understand it, are that as many as 74% of undocumented immigrants in the United States are considered essential workers, far higher percentage than about the 65% in the native-born labor force. What has been the difference between how the Trump administration dealt with pandemic relief and the Biden administration from what you've been able to tell?
Well, the Trump administration worked hard to make COVID relief unavailable to most undocumented workers. And there was a revision in terms of stimulus relief at the end of last year so that at least the families that had American citizen children and American citizen spouses, if there was an undocumented taxpayer in that family, those families did become eligible, finally, for some forms of COVID relief. But in general, what we found in New Bedford was that in spite of the fact that these undocumented immigrants were working, they were paying their taxes, and most of their kids were American citizen children, the difference over the length of the pandemic in terms of their income from federal COVID aid and the income of a family that had American citizen taxpayers, that difference was almost $35,000. To put that in perspective, a family of seafood packing workers doesn't make that much money in an entire year under normal circumstances, and certainly not during the pandemic. So these families, in spite of the fact that they were essential workers, endured this really punishing income gap with American families who were able to stay home and collect unemployment insurance and protect themselves during the pandemic.
And do you have any sense of how many states, if any, have been able to plug the gap somewhat by creating state-level essential workers funds or pandemic relief funds? I know there is one in New Jersey that was passed recently for excluded workers who might be undocumented. What is this, a trend across the country, or is it just a few of the blue states?
I think that New York was also one of the states that did that, but that did not happen in Massachusetts, where we were reporting. What did happen in Massachusetts and across the country was, in terms of federal aid, was the availability to undocumented workers who were paying their taxes and who were being paid in paychecks of the child tax credit. This child tax credit that is the center of the debate right now in Washington did become available because of some changes that the Biden administration made last March to the terms of the child tax credit. And so these long-suffering families who had basically endured the entire pandemic without any form of federal assistance or very limited federal assistance, in August, they started to receive direct payments into their bank accounts of $300 or $360 per child if the child was an American citizen. And we really got a view of how significant these payments are. For many of these families, this was the difference between having food on the table for their children and not. It was the difference between being able to pay the rent and continue to be housed and not be able to do that. It was the difference between being able to pay a mobile phone bill and a Wi-Fi bill. And these are not luxuries anymore. These were fundamental life-saving tools. And it meant and during the pandemic, these were necessary tools for their kids to go to school. And again, we're talking about kids who are American citizens. They were born in this country. They go to school in our communities. They're just like our kids, our American citizen kids. And so what you had an opportunity to see in New Bedford at the end of the process last year was the enormous positive impact that these child tax credit payments can have on the lowest income families, and especially on these families that have worked so hard, despite their immigration status, despite the struggles that they face in the immigration system, they worked so hard to put food on our tables during the pandemic.
And despite the fact that many of them pay taxes. Now, I think
yes.
The power of your piece is some of the people the two of you interviewed for this piece. Let's turn to Lucia Mateo Perez.
Yo soy una niña muy soñadora.
I am a dreamer. I don't just want a car. My dreams reach further than that. I never had a childhood playing with toys. I never had that because we live in extreme poverty. We are deeply discriminated against in our country for the fact that we are women and for the fact that we have brown skin, but more than anything, for the fact that we are indigenous.
That's Lucia Mateo Perez. Her photograph is the top photograph on the piece. Ariel, if you can talk about who some of these people are. This is the flesh, the stories, the beauty of this piece.
Yeah, so to give a sense of who people are and the kind of work that they were doing, these are people who are waking up long before the sunrise, who are going and working in cold packing plants for 9 hours a day. I talked to a woman who stands on a packing line every day, you know, jackets on under her robes, picking out the imperfections of the day's catch with tweezers. These are people who, as Julia mentioned, endured extreme hardship through the pandemic and, you know, through the continuation of the pandemic that we're all living right now. We spoke to mothers who were forced to eat cereal for days when their hours were cut in order to give better food to their children. These were stories of survival, of people who left out of almost all federal aid had to lean on one another. People who converted cramped apartment kitchens into food businesses that they sold to their neighbors. I spoke to someone who was a subsistence farmer in his country. And when he lost his work, he knew he did what he knew how to do, which was grow vegetables and sell them in town. So these are stories of survival. These are stories of deep inequality, as Julia mentioned. But I think that the larger point here is that these are American stories. This is the story not only of how this one immigrant community survived, like so many immigrant communities are surviving by relying on one another throughout the country, but it's the story of how food arrived on all of our tables. It's the story of the people whose hands the cod, the flounder, the scallops passed through and were packaged by before it arrived on your table. So I think that that's kind of what it represents, is sort of this larger question that's being addressed in Build Back Better, which is how is our country going to treat the workers that their labor is essential to its function?
In fact, New Bedford is the scallop capital of the world. In the case of Lucia Mateo Perez, we know her name in your story because she is now documented. Ariel, if you can talk about that.
Yes. So Lucia is a person who was granted asylum. She came here in 2015. She was a seafood worker for the first year of her time in the United States. But Lucia is also a person that we spoke to because she was a survivor of a fire that happened last year, a fire that displaced 40 families, the majority of whom were seafood workers. And we chose to focus on this fire because we were trying to understand, you know, going into 2 years of the pandemic, what are the effects of not having received aid on people? How are we seeing that not only at the beginning of the pandemic when we heard so many stories of what it was to live, you know, for so many of these communities in the epicenter of the pandemic, but what does it mean now 2 years in? And what we found were stories like the one that Lucia's family went through, stories of deep housing insecurity, of families who had to begin living together. The place where they lived that, you know, went up in flames, two people died in this fire. There were, according to residents, fire alarms did not go off. And now after that, they've now been displaced and are, you know, the few belongings that they did have that they were able to accumulate over years of hard work, things like couches, you know, something to sort of create a space for their family are all gone. And they're forced to live in a place that is even smaller. And, you know, we're all learning about what that means and what they're reckoning with now with Omicron on the horizon.
This is Diego, the son of an out-of-work seafood worker in New Bedford, Massachusetts.
It's pretty hard for me. He can't, like, buy us some, like, school supplies, something like that, shoes, clothes. How is he going to work? How is he going to get money for our food and stuff like that?
And this is T.S., an undocumented seafood worker, speaking to the Marshall Project.
We are not free in this country. They can come and take me at any time, and my children would stay here suffering. If I had a social, it might be different. But since I don't, I am in the hands of God.
And Julia Preston, as we hear these voices, we're hearing the voices of immigrants from the highlands of Guatemala, well known for the persecution that whole population faced for decades after the U.S. intervened and supported the military dictatorships there. If you can relate that to current immigration reform today and what's not happening in this country as they face depression there and then come to the United States and face this hard here?
Well, I mean, especially for this community that we saw in New Bedford, the lack of immigration status is just become, during the pandemic, incredibly punishing. And you really see how the failure of Congress to advance some kind of broader immigration reform to just bring these people into a basic legal status has really not only at this point affecting workers who were so essential to keeping us fed and keeping, you know, providing home care. They did so much work for us during the pandemic for the rest, the larger community. The failure of Congress to pass immigration reform has really, it's not only just punishing those people, but now we have generations of American citizen kids who are growing up, and because of the failure of Congress to correct this legal status for these folks, now they're American citizen kids who were born in this country. They're not going anywhere. They're going to grow up here, are being punished as well. And so I think the one of the points that we should see is that even while the immigration, the explicit immigration provisions in the Build Back Better bill that President Biden has put forward and that is under debate in the Senate, those have run into tremendous procedural hurdles, and it's really not clear what's going to happen with those provisions. The child tax credit provisions are also very important for undocumented people that to give them some kind of basic support going forward as we struggle again with another chapter of the pandemic. So I think it's great to focus also on the child tax credit provisions as another aspect of immigration reform that is potentially could happen in this bill.
And I wanted to ask Ariel, in terms of the children of these workers, there's been a lot of emphasis in recent months on the mental health crisis among young people in the United States. In terms of the children of these workers, what kind of services are or may not be available to them? And how did you see in your reporting the mental health impact on them of the situation during the pandemic?
Yeah, so while we were in New Bedford, we surveyed 39 middle school age children just about what their experiences were like in the pandemic. We heard a range of responses. We heard from children who talked about enduring mental health issues. You know, we're talking people who are around 13 years old. We heard from people who simply said that all they did was have faith and try to survive. We also heard about children who had to look for work for whatever reason. Their parents in the pandemic weren't able to provide for their families. And so many of them got part-time jobs. We spoke to teachers who had children signing into their Zoom classes from production lines in packing plants and in lots of the other sort of industrial in places in New Bedford. So in terms of what kind of support was available to children, I mean, this is tied to this larger issue of, because when children's parents are denied many forms of federal aid because of their status, how does this trickle down to the children? So that was some of the things that we heard.
What most shocked you, Julia Preston, about this? And if you could also explain the difference between the Social Security number, the Social, and the 18.
Yeah, you heard the seafood worker refer to that. She said, you know, if only I had a Social Security number, things might be different. But as it is, I'm in the hands of God. So undocumented workers cannot obtain Social Security numbers, valid Social Security numbers. But an undocumented worker who is working in a factory setting or any kind of institutional setting is paid and is paid with a paycheck. They are having their standard deductions, and they are paying taxes just like everybody else who works in that kind of a context. And so the IRS has created a special number. It's called an ITIN, so that those workers can file their taxes and pay their taxes and and if they are eligible, receive certain kinds of refunds. In most cases, until recently, they weren't eligible for many kinds of refunds or tax credits. But this is another form of discrimination. This is tax discrimination that these workers are facing. And it really seems particularly unfair in this context because they are working hard, they are paying their taxes, they are doing exactly what other people do who do have legal status and valid Social Security numbers, and yet they, excuse me, and yet they are not eligible for so many of the benefits that come from being a taxpayer for other people. And so that was, I think what I would say was shocking for me was to see the level of poverty that these families were plunged into, were forced into during the pandemic, even though they were continuing to work. The kind of hardship that these families were facing, and particularly that these kids were having to endure, was really shocking. That shocked me. I've seen a lot covering immigration over the years, but the level of hardship that these families endured really did, it was something I had not seen before.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us, and we're going to link to your piece. Julia Preston, contributing writer at the Marshall Project, Ariel Goodman, Toe Fellow at the Marshall Project, will link to Essential But Excluded. Immigrants put seafood on America's tables, but many have been shut out of pandemic aid, and so have their U.S. citizen children. Next up, we go inside the sprawling network of private immigration jails for an update on conditions amidst the latest surge in COVID infections. Stay with us.
En los suelos y los cielos, poco más danza agua y fuego, danza el árbol con el viento. Espiral de tiempo. De la raíz de la tierra crecen los versos que entintan esperanza. La abuela Ishmucanete teje melodías al alma, sin color ni distinción. Los pueblos bailan y cantan. Somos viento, somos sol y sueños multicolores. Somos este norte, sur y oeste. Somos historia, lienzo y canción. Escribimos el tiempo junto a voces y miradas. Nuestros sueños navegan bajo el sol.
Somos by the Guatemalan indigenous singer Sara Curuchich. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As concerns grow about record COVID infections across the United States, we look now at conditions in the sprawling network of jails run by ICE, that's Immigration and Customs Enforcement, where the Biden administration is holding more than 22,000 people who are often transferred around the country. ICE says fewer than 300 people in detention are being monitored for COVID. Rights advocates say this is surely an undercount. Most of the ICE jails are run by private prison companies like GEO Group, which are not transparent. In Washington state, people held in GEO Group's Northwest ICE Processing Center say conditions have gotten even worse during the pandemic after a federal judge ruled the company must pay detained people minimum wage for work, like cooking and cleaning, instead of paying them a dollar a day. GEO Group responded by suspending its so-called voluntary work program. On December 13th, GEO Group issued a memo at the Northwest ICE Processing Center that, quote, no detainee is permitted to do any work previously done under the program, including but not limited to work in the kitchen, the laundry areas, cutting hair, painting, waxing, or scrubbing floors, or cleaning the secure areas of the facility. This is Ivan Sanchez, held for more than a year at GEO Group's ICE jail in Tacoma. In a call from inside to the group La Resistencia, he describes what happened after the federal judge ordered GEO Group to pay the detainees a living wage for their work.
We lost all our jobs and we weren't able to work anymore. So the facilities stayed dirty for about since it lasted until now. They said they were going to hire a special crew to come and clean the facility, but that still hasn't happened. And they don't want none of us to clean, and some of the officers aren't cleaning. There is a few, though, that do clean. Other than that, I'd like to say that I worked for them for about 3 years, and I also cleaned floors in addition to that, and I did barbershop, and they wouldn't pay me for that, so I would just get a soda or sandwiches or some chips and candy. That was it.
This comes as Washington State recently passed a law barring private for-profit prison companies from contracting with agencies there. But GEO Group has signed a contract to keep its ICE jail in Tacoma open until 2025. For more, we're joined by Maru Mora Villalpando, the co-founder of La Resistencia and a longtime immigrant activist. In September, the government dropped its deportation case against her and granted her lawful permanent residency. Welcome back to Democracy Now! Congratulations on your immigration status. Can you talk about why the Tacoma jail is open, and then talk about what's happening inside with this change of what should happen to work to the prisoners who are also workers?
Yes, thank you. Good morning, Amy. What we've seen is that the detention center is still open, although their contract says from 2015 that it will be open for 10 years because that's what the last contract was signed for. We know that every year Congress has to approve the budget for this kind of work, in this case for detention centers to continue operating. Actually, the Attorney General here in Washington filed a countersuit in September against GEO for remaining open regardless of our HB 1090 law. And so according to the Attorney General, for every day that they remain open, they will have to pay a fee. We assume that by next September, we can actually get it shut down because, yes, they are violating the law. Obviously, GEO filed an appeal to this lawsuit, and that's what they spend the money on. They spend their money on fighting lawsuits of this kind, and they usually lose. And in the meantime, what they decided to do was to remain, to keep people remaining detained in squalor conditions in filth. It took over a month for GEO to actually hire an outside company. The company is called Trust Us. And what we heard from people in detention is that there's some instances where about a crew of maybe 2 to 3 people show up to clean, but maybe for half hour, maybe at the most an hour. And we're talking about units that hold maybe 60 to 100 people in total. Maybe that's not the total that we have right now in every pod. As far as we know, in December 30th, there were 411 people detained. It's way less than the average that was 1,500 in the past pre-pandemic. Yet, there is still a lot of people detained. There's no social distancing. People are still facing COVID. Just from December 22 to December 30th, there were 5 cases of COVID in the detainee population. There were 7 cases of GEO guards with COVID in that same period of time, plus 3 ICE employees also testing positive for COVID. So having a crew of 2 to 3 people showing up for half hour, maybe an hour, maybe 2 to 3 days sporadically here and there in different units is not going to solve the problem of having unsanitary conditions. This, the way we see it and based on what people in detention have told us, is nothing but retaliation against people detained that, thanks to their work, thanks to the hundreds of thousands of people going on hunger strike, they sounded the alarm about this exploitation. And now that Washington State passed the law against this kind of detention centers, and also a federal jury and a federal judge determined that this should not be the case and people should be paid for their labor. What GEO does is they come against people in detention and they retaliate and they just create further worse unsanitary conditions in the middle of a global pandemic.
And Maru, I wanted to ask you, does the GEO Group is obviously is a national private prisons company. It has more than 100 jails and detention centers around the country. Could you talk about what in the lawsuit that what that exposed the exploitation of people there. There was something called the sanitation memo you found that you referred to as the Hunger Games. Could you explain that memo and what it signified?
Yes. So we knew once the first hunger strikes started happening here in the detention center in Tacoma and really throughout the country that GEO has relied on the voluntary work program, which they pay $1 a day for all this kind of work, really to create people detained as a slave labor to be the backbone of the detention center. But there's also a part of that program that doesn't give any money to people in detention. So another way to make people, or everyone, regardless of you choosing to go into this voluntary work program or not, everyone had to clean. That meant that every week there will be a contest that we call the Hunger Game. A contest, so every pod will compete against each other to see who's the cleanest pod. And the reward was a night with the Xbox that you can borrow and chicken for the night. Because obviously the food that is given to people in detention is nothing but trash. That's another of the demands that people that have staged hunger strikes have actually named as number one. They want real food. And so the conditions that GEO created in the first place of hunger, it's used by pushing people to clean the units. So the most recent one that we saw in early December, there were these two pods that won, C3 and A2, I believe. And actually, one of the pods that remained in third place called us, and the people in that pod told us, well, yeah, C3 is going to win because there's very few people there. But if you compare to our pod, there's way many of us here. We cannot compete against a pod that there's less people and they produce less trash, let's say. So this is another way in which GEO profits from not only the detention of people, but to actually make them clean, make them sustain the facility. People in detention did everything except security in the detention center. And now that GEO is saying, no, they're not going to do it because they refuse to pay the minimum wage, people still feel obligated to clean because they don't want to live in a squalor. They don't want to live in filth. And they're afraid of the conditions in regards to COVID as well.
Finally,
and in relation,
go ahead, Juan.
In relationship to COVID, you mentioned ICE has said that 9 people held in its sprawling network of for-profit jails have died from COVID. What is your sense, especially with the Omicron, the spread of the Omicron variant? What is happening in terms of COVID in these detention facilities?
Well, it's spreading fast. We saw an uptick in June. We actually kept track of numbers since June, when actually the Biden administration started transferring more people throughout the country. We've seen an increase in detention. You know, the numbers of people detained have grown since Trump left. When Trump left, we were at 15,000 capacity. Now we're at 21,000, throughout the nation. We even received calls from other detention centers, such as Georgia. Yesterday, we received like 5 calls. People are really worried about it because not only it means transfers are happening and ICE doesn't give absolutely no information about what they do in regards to COVID or anything in general, but also what we've seen is that guards and ICE employees might not be vaccinated. And the way we find out is because in this case in Washington, the notices that ICE has to give to the judge, the immigration judge, because there's a lawsuit pending also in regards to COVID cases, when there's a positive case of COVID, ICE needs to notify this judge, and we get these notices. And what we can tell is that most of the guards and the ICE employees are not vaccinated. Otherwise, the notice will say this person was vaccinated. And so what people in detention have said, not only here, but throughout the nation, is most of the COVID cases that we're going to get in detention come from outside. That means all these employees that refuse to get vaccinated, they bring the COVID in, and we have no recourse, knowing also that we have suffered medical neglect for years and years and in detention centers.
Mora Villalpando, we want to thank you so much for being with us, well-known immigrant rights activist. As we turn to Europe, where a French humanitarian group has filed a complaint against Britain and France over the drowning of 27 refugees. Stay with us. The Lost Singer by Ismail Kassim. The song was part of the Calais Sessions, a benefit album recorded at the Calais refugee camp with refugees and professional musicians years ago. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we turn to Europe, where a remarkable new legal complaint accuses Britain and France of failure to help people in need. To the 27 refugees who drowned when the boat they were in capsized while trying to cross the English Channel in November, at least three of the victims were children. It was the biggest single loss of life in the Channel, according to the International Organization for Migration. The complaint also accuses authorities of involuntary manslaughter. According to the only two survivors, refugees made distress calls to French and English rescue services after their boat capsized and started sinking in the freezing waters off the French port city of Calais. They were ignored. At least two of the group were able to call British authorities and tell them their location. One of the refugees who drowned, Shakar Ali Perot, sent this voice message to his family in Iraq. His message is believed to be the last known communication from the boat.
We are still in the sea between UK and France. We're not sure who's coming to rescue us. If you haven't heard from me, we're in the UK. I will throw this phone away. If we stay in French waters, I will answer you.
Perot said if he made it to British shores, he would throw his phone into the water, keeping with the demand that is reportedly often made by migrants, by smugglers concerned with protecting their identities. At least 16 bodies of Kurdish migrants who drowned in the disaster were returned to Iraq just over a week ago, where they were greeted by grieving family members and friends. This is Zana Mohammed, brother of one of the drowned migrants.
They all had phones, internet, and SIM cards, and they could have located them before they drowned. And they actually called the French police and the British police. So we feel that the police betrayed us because they went to them 12 hours after they drowned. So after these 12 hours, they were dead.
Now, a new lawsuit filed by the French humanitarian group Utopia 56 aims to hold authorities accountable for the deaths. This is attorney Emmanuel Daoud.
We're saying that from the moment the rescue services, English and French, were informed between 2 and 3 a.m. that this boat was in distress, it would have been necessary, and it is a legal obligation that they coordinate and intervene. That was not the case.
For more, we go to Paris to speak with Nikolai Posner, communications coordinator for Utopia 56, the French humanitarian group focusing on refugee rights that's filed the complaint. Nikolai, welcome to Democracy Now! If you can explain what happened and what your demands are now, this horror that took place.
Well, as you just said, I mean, on that night, first you have to know that there is people trying to cross every day. Since the beginning of this year, we had 30,000 people reaching UK through the sea. So this is actually very common. As soon as the weather, well, is considered good, people are trying to cross on the boats that you can see in the Mediterranean Sea, over 50 to 60 people over a boat sometimes. What happened that night is that, so those people have been trying to cross. And once they were in the water and in trouble with their boat, they try to contact both authorities, so French and English, and both have sent each other the responsibility of coming to save them. And actually no one came. So we have those testimonies first. And then what we have as well is that 4 days before, on the 20th of November, we were facing the same situation. People on a boat have been contacting our volunteers, calling for help, saying, we are contacting both of authorities and no one is responding. So we wanted to just make sure that to carry the voice of the families first, the relatives back in Iraq, in Iran, Afghanistan, Vietnam, Egypt, to carry their voice and to bring the truth and the transparency on what happened. Also that our society has to keep our eyes open on the real situation of what is happening there. There is a system of mistreatment and violence that is instilled by our politics that we deeply have to change and that push to those tragedies. So at the moment, what the state did just after the tragedy is that they point at the smugglers. But the smugglers are consequences of the politics that are made. So as soon as we saw, or as soon as we saw that something was actually missing into the secure, well, the response to save the people, we wanted to make sure that this will mark a point that to say to our governments that people are looking at the situation and we will not let this happen again and again.
And Nikolai, could you talk about what countries the refugees are coming from, those who are trying to cross the channel, and why are they bent on getting to the UK when they are already within the European Union? Is there the sense that they would have a more welcoming situation in the UK than they would in France or Germany?
Yeah. So, well, you have people from whole different region in conflict. So it's mostly people from Sudan, from Eritrea, Afghanistan, a lot of people from Iraq, Iran, from mostly Kurdistan. And all those people, of course, have been crossing different countries in Europe, but couldn't find a safe place. And so why the people are trying to cross to England, for most of them, it's to run away from the system that is not welcoming in Europe at the moment. You have to know that in Europe, there is some procedures that make it almost impossible for you to apply in another country than the first one you arrived, which is for most of the time, Italy, Greece, or Spain. And then as soon as you move to another country, this country must send you back to the first country you arrived. So at the moment, actually, England becomes the last exit for the people to actually being able to apply for asylum. And so those people are running away from those administrative system that we have in Europe to actually being able to apply. And the second reason is, for example, in France, if you apply for asylum, you know that you will spend days and weeks and months in the street before you get actually a shelter. When actually, if you cross to England, but also different other country of Europe, you will get a shelter, you will get protection. So at this moment in France, we have a system that actually pushed the people away. That's our strategy, is to push the people away a maximum for the next one to not come again. But this doesn't work, because for now, because of the situation of those regions in the world, we are still in a better situation, and we will probably stay that way. So if we really want the people to not come, should we become in a worse situation than Afghanistan or Sudan? I think the only answer that now is offered to the people doesn't fit. And so push those people to go to England.
And quickly, we just have about 20 seconds, but can you characterize the anti-immigrant climate in France right now?
Well, it's... you know, we have election in 3 months, and the anti-speech is based on hatred. It's based on splitting the people to make the people fight against each other. The migrants are supposed to be responsible of all the difficulties our society can face, which is a complete lie, and which will just destroy first the life of those people, and then, of course, the society as a whole. So, I mean, the only solution to come over this situation is to actually to welcome the people and to behave with care. But this, at the moment, sadly, our governments are not ready.
Nikolai Posner, we want to thank you for being with us with the French humanitarian group Utopia 56. And we end today's show with condolences for our dear co-host at Democracy Now!, Nermeen Sheikh, on the death of her khala,
her aunt, Parveen Sharvani, in Pakistan. All the best to you and your family, Nermeen. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Berkdine, Augusta Messiah Rhodes, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Malkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, and Mary Conlon. Our general manager is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Wear a mask.
Email from school about the incident today.
Scary.
You know, teachers like me, parents, we don't always know as much as you guys do about what's going on with other kids.
Half the time, it's rumors.
Yeah, but if you're ever concerned about a friend who's having trouble with alcohol, prescription drugs, anything, you need to tell an adult, someone you know and trust. That can be hard, but speaking up about a problem is what helping a friend is all about.
For more information, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
Let's get back into the music. These guys are coming to town for a few nights in November.
Late night radio needs somebody like you. Late night radio needs somebody like you. I think that you could be the midnight DJ and play the records on the air like you say.
Certificate for